because we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 22nd day of February 2011, and this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and in the studio today we have Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning Bill, good morning listeners.
And we have we have Phil York from Dads in Distress. Good morning Phil.
Good morning Bill, good morning everyone.
Well, it's a bit of a cloudy day today, a bit of scatty rain, but it might clear up later. I suppose a little bit cooler in Sydney is a relief after the heatwave conditions we've been enduring lately. Well, in the show today, it's a very interesting show. We've got a theme, really, today. It's from boyhood to manhood and the development of boys as they grow into men. So first up, we'll be speaking to Jason Van Genderen. Jason is the creative director of Treehouse Creative, and he must be congratulated about being the runner-up in this year's Tropfest with his film called The Unspoken. This film written as a tribute to his father, who is dying of lung cancer. And later on, we'll be speaking with Stephen Toon. Stephen is director of Consultancy and Community Programs, Australian Institute of Male Health and Studies. And he'll be talking about From Boyhood to Manhood, Difficulties and Challenges of Transition. And in connection with that, there's going to be a symposium run in Adelaide in June of this year. And I suppose before we get started, I should apologise for the quality of the sound on this program. We had major problems last week. I'm hoping it's a little better this week, but we are working on that, and thank you for your patience as we get the sound back to the quality that we would expect. So, with a bit of news that's around and about at the moment, I might mention, first of all, that the Attorney General, Robert McClellan, has released a response to some details on the response to the Family Violence Bill consultation. Very disappointing, really. McClellan said that 400 submissions were received during the public consultation process on the draft Family Violence Bill. And he states that a total of 73% of respondents expressed support for the measures, and a further 10% made no specific comment on the bill, but offered information about personal experience. He says the bill has received significant backing from the community and key stakeholders in the family law system. Then he says that the submissions were received from these key stakeholders in the family law system, individuals, peak bodies, academics, judicial officials and organisations. What he doesn't mention is that undoubtedly he received a lot of submissions from government paid bodies. So it's really the government talking to themselves. And on that topic, I'm aware that a Freedom of Information request has been sent to the government, and it would be very interesting to look behind those figures, the 400 submissions, the 73% that are stated to be expressing support for the measures. See if it really is 73% and who are the people making those submissions. So as more information comes to hand, we will get back to you. And just coming back to the theme for today, which is the From Boy to Manhood, I might just mention that last year we gave significant coverage on International Men's Day. International Men's Day for 2011 is coming up on the 19th of November, and the theme this year is giving boys the best possible start in life. So once again, it's a theme of boys and men growing into men, and the problems that they're facing, and what can be done about it. The support for International Men's Day includes international authors Warren Farrell and Steve Bidoff, both of whom have been on this program, and they are very concerned about the what is happening with young boys in our community at the moment. Our sons have begun to drop out of school at a much greater rate. They're falling behind in reading and writing, and I think Warren Farrell would say we are on the verge of a crisis with our boys. So that is the theme for International Men's Day, and we'll stay in touch with these people as we get closer to November 19. Now, Ian, I think you've got something for us.
Yeah, well, I've got a couple of linked articles here. One that appeared in yesterday's Telegraph. Mick Jobs in firing line is their headline. Axe to fall on apprenticeship subsidies to big business. Steve Lewis wrote, tens of millions of dollars in wage subsidies paid to McDonald's, KFC and other retail giants would be slashed as part of a radical plan to tackle skill shortages and boost apprenticeship numbers. So it would appear that apart from making us all obese, that these large American, usually American, fast food chains are actually causing problems with apprenticeship numbers, that apprenticeship numbers have been dropping. These businesses have been subsidized to hire young people and teach them how to flip hamburgers and run cash registers. I would also like to add to this another heading from the Telegraph. They're too fat to fit in Ambos. Rhys Haynes wrote last week, dial triple XL in an emergency. Ambulance workers are calling for more superstyled vehicles to be deployed across Sydney because of the dramatic rise in cases involving grossly obese patients. And then a further one that appeared in this morning's Telegraph, fat soldiers can't fight. Ian McFedrin wrote, more than 5,600 Australian military personnel are unfit for active duty, with obesity and weight-related illnesses the main culprit. Almost 10% of the 57,800 full-time staff who wear the uniform of Navy, Army or Air Force. In addition to permanent military fatties, more than 12,200 reservists are rated as overweight and more than 4,000 are classified as obese. Now, we can't just put this obesity epidemic down to McDonald's and KFC, obviously, but they are playing more than their fair share, and I certainly would support anything that the government can do to limit the amount of influence they have on the community. They should be banned from advertising to children during children's television hours, and this idea that we're subsidizing them to hire children to teach them that eating this garbage is normal and acceptable must stop as well.
Even in the sporting field, when the kids are out playing sport on the weekend, if they get best on field, they get a Macca's voucher.
Yeah, well, all of this has got to stop. We really must start seeing this stuff. It's not food. It's basically just a conglomeration of ingredients that lawyers cannot prove is not food. But if you take a Big Mac and you leave it out in a paddock, for example, you come back 2 years later and the thing's still sitting there. All of the animals in the field who have not been subjected to a merciless McDonald's advertising campaign are not hoodwinked into thinking it's food. However, we're allowed to apply this garbage onto our children, and they advertise mercilessly. They target children. And the result is, I mean, that we're having to get bigger ambulances because people are too fat. Our soldiers can't fight because they're too fat. There is an obesity epidemic happening in Australia at the moment, and these fast food chains are at least partially responsible for it. They've got to be stopped.
A story from The Australian by Patricia Carvelis, and the headline reads, Fathers Demand Mandatory Paternity Testing. A men's rights group has called for mandatory paternity testing of all babies after government figures revealed almost 600 instances of men compelled to financially support children they did not father. Since the changes to child support laws 4 years ago, there have been 586 cases of men successfully using DNA testing to show they were not biologically related to the children that they had been financially supporting, the federal government has revealed to The Australian. In an overwhelming majority of the cases, the courts have not forced mothers to pay the money back that they have received. Of the 586 cases, only 74 mothers have been told to pay back the money, and those repatriations total in excess of $533,000. The figures from the government's child support agency prompted Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency to call for mandatory DNA testing at birth. Sue goes on to say, quite a lot of these men don't get their money back. The mothers aren't working anyway, so there's no way of getting the money back. These figures are likely to renew a fierce debate over the use of DNA to determine biological parentage after birth. Sue goes on to say that she believed that up to 30% of men who had a test found out that they weren't a father. and she thinks that there should be a mandatory testing at birth of every child just to prevent this from happening. Hear, hear, Sue. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of considerations there. As far as the mandatory aspect of it, already a blood sample is taken, I think, from the heel of a baby when it's born.
Yes, that's correct.
So, really, what's to stop that extending to DNA? And apart from all the ethical aspects of the father perhaps later being compelled to support a child that's not his, which goes against all our biological upbringing, the other aspect is that children may have hereditary diseases. And if there's no understanding of that from who is the natural father because someone refused to have a DNA test, that could have serious implications for the child in later life. So there are a lot of issues there, and really, I think Sue's campaign and others working this field to get the DNA testing should really be supported on a number of those grounds.
As you said, Bill, you're 100% right, mate. They already take a blood test of every newborn baby, so it's a matter of just legislating it and allowing that test to flow through.
Yeah. Now, there's an interesting High Court decision. We've reported on it in the past. It's the case of MRR versus GR, and this is where the High Court allowed an appeal against a decision by the Federal Magistrate's Court that a child spend equal time with each of her parents in Mount Isa, in spite of the mother's application to relocate to Sydney. Now, the High Court has gone to all the trouble of overturning the decision of the full family court, only to find that the mother has since repartnered in Mount Isa and now has no desire to return to Sydney. Typical. Now, another case that's come to light recently involves our own Jason Donovan. That's Kylie's former beau. And Jason Donovan's mother, Sue McIntosh, has been complaining that she's been betrayed by her son, Jason.
Jason has a history of drug abuse and all sorts of big problems.
Yes.
Put a bit of background here.
Yes, I mean, that might have been influenced by what happened, but what happened was that Sue McIntosh walked out of his life when he was just 4 years old. She said it was a bit difficult to see him. She didn't like the atmosphere when she turned up to see him, so she just cut the rope, and she hasn't seen him for years. He says that in his book, the book was actually released some time ago. I'm not quite sure why this story is just coming up now, but in his book, which came out, I think, in 2007, he said that he missed his mother terribly in those first few months, and there is no question that her departure left me with emotional scars. And the mother, just chose not to be in his life at all, and strangely enough is now complaining that what she did is coming out. She's come out with a few excuses, saying that she thinks she wasn't tough enough, but it really goes beyond just making excuses. She chose to walk out of his life, and that's her decision, and she's got to live with it.
Yeah, and the results, of course, as I said, drug addiction, alcohol abuse, all sorts of other problems that Jason suffered in later life. Now, I've got one here. This was sent to me by our researcher, Greg Andreessen. The heading is Sedation Nation, the Cost of Taking Boisterousness Out of Boys. The Ritalin Wars are usually treated as another tussle between the pharmaceutical companies and the rest. But is there something else going on here as well? Is it part of a more generalised covert war on boyhood? 30 years ago, Australian primary schools employed 5 male teachers for every 4 females. By 2006, there was 1 male teacher for every 4 females. This overwhelming of feminisation of primary education and of culture generally has made boy-type behaviour stuff to frown upon. Are we in danger of seeing boyhood itself as a disorder? When Christopher Lane, author of Shyness, How Normal Behaviour Became a Sickness, quoted a psychoanalyst saying, "We have a word for sufferers of ADHD. We call them boys." He probably did not expect it to become the most famous line of his book. Lane's point was more general, about how personality traits that were once tolerated and even celebrated are now treated as disorders. What was once introversion is now called avoidant personality disorder. Nervousness is social anxiety disorder or dating anxiety disorder, and so on. It's not that these disorders don't exist, says Lane, a Guggenheim fellow studying the ethics of psychopharmacology, but that our definitions are so broad that the entire mysterious subconscious is reduced to chemical balance and any deviation looks like disease. Why, he asks, is ADHD so commonly diagnosed in boys? Is it new behavior or just a new attitude to that behavior? A report last year by Dr. James Scott and others in the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry suggests the latter. Ritalin prescriptions have quadrupled in 7 years, which might be explained by the drug being covered by a government subsidy. We're not the same thing happening overseas. And there is also this, although in Australia as elsewhere, the male to female ADHD ratio is 2.45 to 1, Ritalin rates are 5 to 1. Diagnosis is more than twice as likely in boys and medication more than twice as likely again. So once again, the pharmaceutical and the medical professions appear to be waging war on male behavior, because boys are less easy to control and to dominate in a classroom situation.
Finally, just returning to the story that Phil was bringing us a little while ago about the DNA testing. In America, the American Coalition for Fathers and Children has released a story. It's a developing story, and this is where comedian Carl LeBove was best friend and opening act for legendary comic Sam Kinison. Yesterday, or recently in Los Angeles, Carl filed papers calling for his release from over $188,000 in child support arrears and obligations for a child that newly released DNA testing proves is not Carl's, but is in fact his best friend Sam Kinison's. This story is gaining national attention in the US, with over 200 media outlets carrying the news. So that's a story we'll be following, and it's a story that resonates in Australia as well, with the DNA testing and the child support agency regime. So we might go to a short break, and we'll be back with our first guest, Jason Van Genderen.
Jumbo planes, taking a ride on a cosmic train. Switch on summer from a slot machine. Just get what you want to if you want, 'cause you can get anything. I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day, but tell me, where do the children play? Well, you roll on roads over fresh green grass, for your lorry loads pumping petrol gas. And you make them long, and you make them tough, but they just go on and on, and it seems that you can't get off. Oh, I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day, but tell me, where do the children play? sky. Scrapers fill the air. But will you keep on building higher till there's no more room up there? Will you make us laugh? Will you make us cry? Will you tell us when to live? Will you tell us when to die? I know we've come a long way. We're changing day to day. But tell me, where do the children play?
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. We're just getting through to Jason Van Genderen, who's on a shoot at the moment. We'll be hearing from Jason in a minute or so. So just while that call's coming in, in fact, it might even be there right now. And Jason, good morning.
Hi, Bill. Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Jason, let me first of all congratulate you on your runner-up prize in the Tropfest.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much.
That is a fantastic effort. I think there were 15 finalists from about 400 entries. Is that correct?
Actually, there were 16, I think, from about 700 or 800. It was quite a huge number, yeah.
It's getting even better. Well, we have with us in studio this morning Phil York, who last year was a finalist also with the Dad's in Distress film called Every Second Weekend. So he knows what you've been through.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, great.
Well done, Jason. Congratulations, mate.
Thank you.
Jason, of course, we're very interested in the film that was called The Unspoken, and I've seen it this morning. For anyone that is interested, you can go to the Tropfest website and you'll be able to see the award-winning film from Jason, and I'd recommend that to everybody. I've got a couple of questions. There's a key, I believe, to each of these Tropfest entries. What was the key this year and how did you deal with it?
Well, I added the key in via one line in the narrative. So, with the signature item you must include in the film, you can use it in any which way. It can be visual, can be subliminal, can be in the audio. It doesn't really matter. So, fortunately for me, I was able to include it just in the narrative.
And what was the key?
It actually was a key this year, wasn't it, Jason?
It was key, yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. An actual key.
An actual key, with the word key, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, look, I found the film very, very moving. Your father didn't speak at any stage in the film, and
no.
I think one of the aspects of the film was that you said in raising you, the raising wasn't necessarily done in speech. It was a showing of the way. Was that one of the themes of the film?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think probably from a lot of fathers from my dad's generation particularly, they've sort of been brought up, they've gone through the war, they've come back, they've been the bread earners in the family, and I guess as soon as they started raising family, it was more a case of, there's certainly plenty of love in the family and plenty of interaction between my parents and myself and my sister. However, I guess it's one of those things, between dads and sons or dads and kids, do they really relate that much on a day-to-day level in spoken words? And I know for sure my dad, whilst he wasn't afraid of speaking, it certainly, in my teenage years growing up, we probably didn't speak as much as what we should have. And it's probably fortunate that we've discovered the friendship that we have now, albeit in his last days, that we feel we can open up to each other that way.
Now, Jason, you've got a history of making films. You started off making comedies and then you've built a reputation for emotional short films. I know you've won awards for My Town is Broken about urban decay in Gosford. Mankind is No Island about homelessness, which won the Tropfest New York Award in 2008. Very impressive.
That's right.
So what drove you to make this particular film about The Unspoken?
Well, with The Unspoken, it was really, I guess, for me, I wasn't making it for any particular film festival initially. I had actually shot The Vision with my dad about a year ago with a cinematographer by the name of Gavin Banks. And what I really was interested in doing was creating a bit of a video portrait of my father. And then what I wanted to do was communicate to him through film, which is a medium that he's got a lot of respect for in what I do, trying to communicate through that type of storytelling what he meant to me growing up and the sorts of values and properties he's instilled in me as a young man, I guess, taking on the world and I guess trying to sort of attribute that back to my father and try and give him some thanks for that. So the film basically was me trying to explore that theme and trying to reach out and give him that piece. And the fact that my father is in the final stages of lung cancer obviously drew some immediacy to trying to tell the message as well. Mm. And the battle I was finding was I'd shot this vision, which was beautiful, and then I just had a lot of trouble trying to piece the words together, even in a filmic form, to explain to him how I felt. And
was that because it was emotional for you, or was it just difficult?
I think it's really difficult when you sit down and try and say, well, if I'm going to make a statement with this and I'm actually going to reach out and create something that he's going to play over and over to watch, you really become very self-critical about what you're doing. And I think as much as I tried, I guess I wrote down lots of lines over the course of that year, and I'd read it and I'd look at it and I'd say it sounded, to me, it would maybe sound contrived or something. So I really needed to let that idea sit and settle within me. And fortunately, I got a bit of a kick up the bum, I guess, with the fact that Tropfest was out there and calling for submissions. And whilst I was very aware of that and I wasn't making the film for Tropfest, I used the deadline as my deadline to say, well, I need to make this film now and get this to Dad while he's still here to enjoy it. Mm. And I managed to do that a few days before the deadline was due for Tropfest. Showed Dad and then showed some other family members, and they were really thrilled with it and said, look, why don't you put it into something like Tropfest? Because there's themes and messages in here that other people can learn from as well. So I'm really glad I did, obviously,
yes.
In hindsight, to be able to use it as a tool to reach out to other families and other fathers and other sons to sort of hopefully encourage people to start talking more rather than having that real stereotype closed door approach between males in a family.
Yes, understandably so, that you receive that encouragement having now seen the film. And your father has now seen the film. Has he had any comment on it?
Oh, look, he loves it. He was obviously intensely proud of I guess what I was saying in there, but I think for him, what my mum told me was pretty much every day after I left him the DVD, he was kind of watching it pretty much every day for a good week or so, just picking up something different out of it every single day. And for me, that was my prize. My prize was being able to create something that connected with him and reached out to him and told him exactly how I felt. And the one thing I didn't want to be doing was to I couldn't imagine standing at his funeral one day and delivering a eulogy and saying all these magnificent things about him that he's never going to hear. So I really wanted the film to be something I could be proud of and stand in front of him and say, look, Dad, this is how I feel about you, and I'm proud to be able to put it out there and show you. And I guess whilst the message was really, really personal between him and I think it obviously had some universal themes in there as well, which other audiences picked up on.
Yes, and the main message is that, as I suppose, just the love between you and your father, would you say that's the case?
I guess so, yeah, and also just celebrating the fact that, that there are just so many things in a father-son relationship that deserve to be acknowledged as well, and there's just so many life skills and a lot of ambient things that you probably don't really sit down and take much notice of until you're faced with that possibility of having to say goodbye to someone. And you sit back and you review through your life and your upbringing, you say, wow, these are the things that my father has instilled in me, and these are the things I need to recognise. And I guess in large parts, even though my father was very creative and he was a fantastic sculptor, he taught me really the art of storytelling, because he would show me things creatively in the works that he did that I would then, define meanings for. And I think he was largely responsible for me becoming a creative filmmaker, if you like, or a storyteller in my own right. So it's really, for me, he sort of looks at what I do and goes, wow, well, what have you grown into and how did you become this? And I love your films, whereas I really need to turn around and say to Dad, well, you know what, I'm doing this because of you and you've really instilled these properties within me.
Yes, I guess it's a bit of a mixture. I mean, in the film, you draw out the special things between you and your father, and you mentioned your father's a sculptor, and the influence, the particular influence he's had on you in being an award-winning film director and producer. But I guess there are also some universal themes between men and their children that you could bring out in your film as well.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I think, you know, being a father myself too, I've got both a son and a daughter, and you do become much more aware of those connections and what they mean. And I think, you know, the current generation is growing up quite differently to, obviously, my father's generation. But, yeah, I guess this film really celebrates that too, and tries to encourage people to open up and speak. Yeah, if you had the opportunity to tell someone how you feel about them today as opposed to tomorrow, then maybe that's something you should consider doing, and particularly with you know, if you have elderly parents, or just even having a look on the comments on the YouTube channel from people that have watched the film and been sort of describing how it's affected them. It's stunning to see how many people have actually watched it and said, wow, I can really relate to this in my own family context, or I've lost my father to cancer, or I've lost my husband to cancer, and I wish that I'd sort of explored some of these things before they were taken away from me.
That's a great thing to do, and really these days, with the availability of the video technology, it's something that perhaps everyone should think of doing. In my own case, I did an amateur David Frost type interview where I sat down with my parents about 10 years ago and interviewed them on their family history, which I now highly value, and I think a lot of people don't think of doing, you know, what you've done, which is to get that recorded. I suppose the only problem is encouraging your parents to sit down and do it, recognising that it might be for after they've passed away.
Well, even, I mean, you're quite right. I think just with the accessibility nowadays of cameras, and I mean, every mobile phone's got a video camera on there, even for that matter. You know, it's not that hard to probably sit down and I know several of my friends have sort of been in discussion with me since watching this, saying, wow, I really just want to grab a little video camera and sit down with my mum or dad this weekend and ask them some questions about their life, and really, I guess, document for the sake of family history even, you know, the things that they've gone through. And now with the accessibility of video, I think it's a great way to sort of communicate and store family history as well.
Yes. And do you think making the film drew you even closer to your father?
Look, whether it drew us closer, I don't know. I think it probably just, it probably more just showed to my father exactly how I was feeling in a, I guess, a more concrete way. And I think, he, you know, hopefully the love between a father and a son and vice versa is always something that's fairly, fairly much felt. But I think, if anything, he's probably just more proud of the fact that I came out and said it. And even though, you know, I guess a lot of people, I was worried a lot of people would look at this and go, well, you know, it's a very personal message, it's probably not suitable to be aired in public. But I guess in you know, retrospect now, having seen it out there, I think it's probably got some really good solid messages that people hopefully will be inspired from. And I think if people can take away something from that and apply it to their life or their experiences, then that would be a worthwhile thing for me.
Look, I think it's great that you're standing out there in public, you're saying how much you love your father, and I think in our society, perhaps it's our English heritage, but we're not inclined to say that, are we? We're not inclined to say, I love your father, not inclined to give him a kiss even.
Yeah, yeah. We're seeing, I come from my parents are both Dutch, so coming from a Euro background, it's very easy to, you know, I go visit my folks and I kiss mum twice, you know, either side of the cheek, and I do the same with dad, so it's sort of second nature. But I've noticed, yeah, definitely sort of if you look at a cross culture and look at Australian families, it's very rare for a father and son to sort of reach out that way, I guess.
I think things are improving, and let's hope that that's part of the men now standing up a bit more, and Dad's on the Air even is a vehicle for this sort of thing. Let's hope that it becomes more common. And so what would you see as the main messages from your film?
Well, main messages will probably be to, I guess, reflect on what your parents or your father or your mother have actually contributed to your life, and I guess being grateful for that and recognising that. So I think a lot of people would probably go through life and just know these things but probably never really express it. And I think, yeah, I, in a way, I guess I'm fortunate because I know, this probably going to sound wrong, but I know my dad is going to be taken away from me in the near future. So I'd rather have that opportunity to stand up and tell him, well, I know he can hear it, as opposed to sitting there one day at a funeral service and trying to put those words together. So, I think really what I'd love people to take away from that is a sense of recognizing their relationship with their parents, and then saying, well, if I had an ability or a way to communicate that to them, how would I do that? And when would I do that? And I think that's really a good quality to have.
Absolutely, mate. And just on that reflection, how was it there on Sunday night with 80,000 people? And how was it received? Did you notice that, you know, after your film was aired, could you sense that reflection in people?
You could. You know, it's very difficult when you play at a festival like that, because obviously, I mean, Tropfest is the largest short film audience in the world. I mean, there was 80,000 people sitting in the Domain in Sydney watching that, and it's very different watching a film in the comfort of your lounge room on your little laptop as opposed to sitting there in a big crowd. And I was quite nervous, just wondering how people were going to take it. Obviously, there's usually a lot more comedies and the like.
Yep.
in a festival like Tropfest. So a film with that much gravity is probably a quite a difficult film for an audience to swallow, particularly when they've been sitting around having a few drinks all afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But on reflection, it really, really was a beautiful, just a really nice, relevant moment. And I think once the film played out, it got a nice, respectful applause. And
absolutely.
The comments I got from people around me was just beautiful. We had a lot of people just coming out of the audience, just strangers coming out of the audience, just grabbing me for a handshake or a hug, saying, wow, you really just sort of showed me something I hadn't thought of before, and I'm going to go and change what I do. And I think with any filmmaker, whether you're producing a comedy or a drama or a documentary, you're trying to reach out and connect with an audience and share a message, and whichever way you choose to do that, I think if you can find a way to connect with an audience, that's what it's all about. So yeah, it was just a great experience. It was a wonderful opportunity, and even though my prize was Dad seeing the film, to be able to walk away with a second gong from a festival like Tropfest was just cream. It was just fantastic.
Yep, you've done so much more, mate. You've opened thousands and thousands of people's eyes, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Yes, so from that number of entries, and the quality and the standard of the entries, as always, was extremely high, so it's an extraordinary achievement. And just hearing what you're saying then about many of them have been comedies, which I seem to remember from last year's as well, but of course Phil's video last year, Every Second Weekend, was definitely not a comedy either.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And again, there was that sense of reflection in the audience, which was, I guess, part of the reason behind why we actually shot the film.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and to be honest with you, I mean, it's a good, for a filmmaker, it's a good avenue to actually experiment with new concepts filmically as well. Much the same as the film when we produced for Tropfest New York in 2008, that was really an experiment. And I kind of say to a lot of people when they say, well, how do you go about, you know, being that risky with a message? And I think with a filmmaker, you kind of create something and you know it's either going to be a tremendous success or a spectacular failure, and usually nothing in between.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the line you dance with. That's really the risk you need to take with a message, because it's hard when you make something, you look at it and you look at it 100 or 200 times over and you don't know if it's any good anymore, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
You need to show it to an audience to really get their reaction and their response and see whether it communicates with them what you were originally aiming to set out and achieve.
And we're speaking with Jason Van Genderen, who's the creative director of Treehouse Creative and the runner-up in the recent Tropfest film with his award-winning film, The Unspoken. So, Jason, where to from here?
Well, at the moment, I'm actually working on I guess this could be best coined a reality documentary series titled Me and Megan, and it's a journey where my fiancé travelled to Ethiopia last year to volunteer over there, and we both handed each other a pocket flip camera, a little video camera. And for 8 months, we diarised our lives every day on these little video posts. And so what we're actually working on now is we're producing a little feature documentary out of it to really track our story of our relationship and our two different worlds that we were living in, and seeing how, in a parallel way, they connected and how they didn't connect. So that's it's called Me and Megan, and we've got a page on Facebook with some 6,000 fans now following it. And yeah, we're looking forward to, we're actually in post-production on that right now. So if you watch this space in the next couple of months, we'll hopefully have the film ready to put out there.
Well, we will definitely. We'll be watching the space. As I said, and your day job, the Treehouse Creative, I think it's got three offices, Gosford, Crow's Nest and Melbourne, is that correct?
We do, yes, we do. So,
you're busy, aren't you?
Busy, yeah, very busy out there in the creative world, which is good. I've got a great little team of guys working with me as well. That's, it's not just myself, I've got a great team of creatives working with me. So, we're proud of what we do and we have a lot of fun doing it. And, the film side of things for us is more of a bit of a hobby, I guess, on the side, but hopefully one day... like everyone else, we had to crack it and do a big one.
Well, yes, you've certainly had success so far, and I can, let's hope there might be some Oscars down the line. But
I don't think so, but you never know.
Well, Jason, we're running out of time, but look, I want to thank you particularly for coming on the show. It's been fantastic talking to you, and from Dad's on the Air, we certainly give you all our congratulations for your wonderful film. And as I say, if people want to see the film, go to the Tropfest website and you'll see The Unspoken, the runner-up in the competition from some 600 films that were presented. So, Jason, once again, thanks for coming on the show and wish you all the best with your next project.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Jason.
Meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent, and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air this 22nd day of February 2011. And our next guest is Stephen Toon. Stephen is a Director of Consultancy and Community Programs with the Australian Institute of Male Health and Studies. The Australian Institute of Male Health and Studies is a not-for-profit, non-government organisation which was established to pursue and promote excellence in the fields of male health and male studies through research, education, consultancy and innovative psychosocial clinical practice. Stephen, are you there?
I'm there. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, and welcome to the show. Thank you for making some time available. Now, Stephen, you've got a symposium coming up, I believe, in Adelaide.
We have, on the 24th of June this year.
And I'm just looking at some of the speakers you've got there. Professor Miles Groth, who's been on this show, and Celia Lashley, who's also been on the show.
I had to say you'd know Miles and Celia better than I do.
Well, we've certainly spoken to them. And Professor John Giardini, is it?
It is.
Another child psychiatrist. So could you tell us a little about, I know the title of the symposium is From Boyhood to Manhood, Difficulties and Challenges of Transition. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about how the symposium came to be.
Sure. Probably just by way of background, one of the things we really wanted to do with the symposium, we sort of sat down and said, hey, what are some of the really key issues out there for sort of men and boys and in general, and what we wanted to do with the symposium was really come up with some of the key topics that are really important so that practitioners and workers could get together and really have some informed discussion and good education and really pick up something that they might apply through that. And as we sat down and started to brainstorm the topics, it really, this whole question of transition from boys to men came very much to the fore as a major issue for men and boys. And certainly, in my experience as a dad, I know sort of the journey through those pubescent years are very, very challenging for boys. And as a society, as a culture, we haven't always known quite what to do with boys in those years to help them with the best outcomes.
Yes, well, it's very timely that you're putting this symposium on, because you might be aware that the theme for International Men's Day this year is giving boys the best possible start in life.
Mm.
And I know that Warren Farrell, among others, he believes we're actually on the verge of a crisis with our boys, that he sees as being equivalent to the financial crisis that many of us didn't see until it hit us. So your conference is directed at raising awareness in the community, I guess.
It is very, very much, and not only raising awareness in the community, but creating opportunities for those that are working with boys to actually get together and look at the whole question of how that practice might be improved to help boys with these transition years.
Now, you've worked in preventative mental health, suicide prevention, personal development programs, and you see all these having relevance to the topic?
Very much, yeah. Very much an issue of mental health, very much an issue of suicide prevention, very much an issue of personal development, I guess, is really about creating the very best outcomes for boys. It's about making that journey as easy as we can.
Yes, and there are a lot of things going on in society that are perhaps making it more difficult. And here I'm thinking of campaigns like the White Ribbon campaign, which is very heavily funded, and it's focused solely on violence of men against women. Never the other way around, or never against children. It's really painting men in a certain way that must be confusing for boys as they develop.
Yeah, can I suggest probably as an organisation, what we're aware of the Institute is as soon as we discuss issues of gender, so often those issues have been clouded by polarisation or characterised by polarisation of the genders. But so often we get into a debate of men versus women, who is better, who is worse, who's come out better. And I guess as an organisation, we're not really interested in buying into those debates. Rather what we want to do is focus on what is best for men and boys, on what good evidence, you know, we want to conduct the best research, come up with the best evidence,
so that we can provide the best education on what is going to produce the best outcome for boys and men, which we believe will ultimately bring about the best outcomes for men, women, and communities as a whole. Mm. Once we start to focus on evidence rather than the ongoing polemic between genders, which isn't really helping men or women or society as a whole.
Absolutely. I think some people assume that by wanting the best for boys or for men, that somehow that's going to take away from what we're doing for women, which, well, enlightened people would not agree with that. It's really, you want to continue the work with women, but you also want to raise the work that's been done with boys and men.
And certainly, and I think probably the best support of that in our experience is we probably get the greatest interest in this area often comes from single mums that just know they're boys. Boys need more, and a credit to them, you know, raising boys on their own, but they're recognising and they're asking for help in this area. How do we help our boys to become men?
Yeah, that's very interesting, and I think once the women do get on site, it's going to be an enormous boon, because they seem to be...
Yeah, well, Bill, I'd want to say, on the whole, I think women are on site, so, so I think as a community we recognise that this is a really important topic.
Yes, and that's great, and if we can get them... you know, with their networking abilities and generally, you know, being involved, I think that's all to the good. We can get this in the mainstream. And what are there any particular problems that you want to focus on with the with boys becoming men?
I guess our interest, and as you read the blurb, I don't think anyone debates that it's a challenging time for men. For me personally, I think as a culture we've lost, you know, historically there have always been means of helping boys through this process, and most cultures have had initiation rites or whatever that have taken them as boys and brought them back as men. And as a culture, we don't really have any way of expressing that process, and I know some people are doing some work in this area, which is great. But essentially, as a whole society, we're not really sure what to do. So our boys hit these difficult years, and we don't know how to best help them. And often we've responded with sort of punitive measures. So we see lots of young men in jail. We've responded with pharmacological solutions. So we see, in fact, interesting, I believe there was an article in the Sydney Morning Herald last week that suggested... 2.5 times more boys diagnosed with ADHD than girls, and yet 5 times more boys are on medication. And again, that's suggesting that we just don't know quite how to deal with the challenges that boys are facing. And so often we're responding with medication, with punitive responses, and we're not quite sure how to best support our boys through these years.
Yeah, just getting back to that point you made there, I actually do have the article in front of me.
I haven't read the article. I was just chatting with a colleague this morning.
Well, I can just quote from it now. Although in Australia, as elsewhere, the male-to-female ADHD ratio is 2.45 to 1, Ritalin rates are 5 to 1, diagnosis is more than twice as likely in boys, and medication more than twice as likely again.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thanks, Ian. That's Ian Purdy in the studio with us as well. Yes, you compare perhaps our society with other societies, say in Aboriginal, American Indian. There's a clear transition from boy to man, whereas in our society it's very easy to get misled and think that you take the wrong path as to what makes you a man, isn't it? And that's really what we should be avoiding.
It is Well, I think to a large extent we've lost, there isn't the expression of masculine community that boys can grow into at the moment. So for me, I'd like to see a renewed emphasis on what contexts can men create community in, and a community that boys can discover what it means to be men.
Could we get back to the subject of initiation that you mentioned before? As you said, lots of so-called primitive societies did have an initiatory process for the boys, and also a lot of them had them for girls as well. What do you think we're losing because we've lost this? We don't initiate our boys. We just assume that they're going to grow up and that they'll be fine. At a certain point, their voice will drop, and then they'll grow facial hair, and then suddenly, hey presto, they'll be men.
Yeah, I think for me, in that process, what we've lost is our ability to affirm boys in their manhood. And so I think most of us as men spend our whole lives trying to affirm our manhood and looking for affirmation of that. Now, I think in all cultures that's a bit tentative anyway, because I think biologically as men that's the way we are. But I think what we need is a way to say to boys, we recognise your journey, we travel this journey with you, we endorse your journey, we want to be part of your journey, and we want to let you know where you are and that you've arrived, and yet celebrate that manhood with you, rather than letting you wonder for the next 30 or 40 years, or however many years you might live for, whether you've arrived or not.
Yes, and we're speaking with Stephen Toon, Director of Consultancy and Community Programs at the Australian Institute of Male Health and Studies. So, Stephen, when things do go wrong, what are the likely outcomes for boys when they take that wrong path and to manhood?
Well, again, we're seeing large numbers of boys in our correction system. They're probably overrepresented. Well, they are overrepresented. We're seeing a lot of boys sort of... I think probably another take on your question is, I think what we're seeing is in the absence of initiation and any structured form of the transition, I think boys are creating their own and looking for their own risk-taking measures. And that's not helpful for boys at all, because what they're doing is trying to initiate themselves without the guidance of a community of older, wiser men, if you like.
Yes, certainly I think boys are recognised as risk takers, and that could lead them down to the wrong path. So do you promote services such as mentoring? Is that a good way to go?
I think mentoring has a lot of potential, and it's been exciting to see the growth of mentoring programs around Australia. Again, I think what's important, though, is that those programs are developed on the very best evidence and the best understanding of boys that we can come up with, so that they're not only well-intentioned but well-informed about what makes boys tick and what the needs of boys are.
Yes, and yeah, I suppose when things do go wrong, Celia Lashley will have an interesting take on that after her work with in prisons. So it'll be, she's been able to do a number of good work, a lot of good work with those children who've gone off the rails. But I guess the idea is to stop them heading off the rails to start with by these proper programs. And your symposium is going to bring this to everyone's attention, I hope, and we can move forward.
Yes, and just listening to you there, probably another aspect of that is so often we look at boys going wrong, and I guess there's almost a tendency to blame boys. And I think one of the things we're really keen to do in this symposium is have a look at our society. So where might we have gone wrong in not supporting our boys? What structural changes might we make or might we work towards that might assist boys rather than sort of encouraging a culture of blaming boys for the way they are? Not that, and one of my arguments would be, look, we're all accountable for who we are and responsible, and certainly for me the journey from boyhood to manhood is about learning to take responsibility, but at the same time we need to recognise that boys are boys and that's the way they made, and we need to find how to best support them in who they are rather than blame them for the way they are.
Yes, well, I mean, there are a lot of contrary influences at the moment. If you look at some of the television advertisements, the way they portray men, if you were to swap their genders, everyone would be affronted. But it just seems to be fair game to present men as being violent or dunderheads or incapable, or you know, all sorts of things.
The Homer Simpson syndrome.
That present men in not a good light, whereas there are so many good things about, particularly about young boys, that really should be recognised.
Mm.
So I know people. There are some. We've been speaking to some people on this program that are focusing on the way that boys and men are presented in the media and what we can do about it. So do you what would you be, do you know, without pre-guessing your symposium, but what do you see as the way forward?
I think that's a very complex question, and again, without pre-guessing, I think almost my response is the way forward at this stage is for people to come together and begin some really meaningful discussions that will not only be about discussion, but about turning discussion into action and practice. So I think one of the really important way forward is to begin to gather people together that are interested, and there is a huge interest out there, we're finding. So I think very much those people need to get together and begin to explore together what are the way forwards. I think we do need to, I think, re-explore the whole question of initiation. I have a strong personal view that we need to re-explore the whole question of a community of men where boys can be part of, and how. But it is very much about I don't want to say begin a discussion, because I know there are lots of people out there discussing already. But I think for me the beginning is to sit down and say, what do we know about boys? What do we know about these difficult years? What can we do to make it better?
And do you see differences between different communities, say an Indigenous community, some ethnic communities versus the Anglo-Australian communities?
I don't think we can deny that there are subtle differences between different communities, but I know in my work with Indigenous men, I've always wanted to say, I'm not Indigenous, I'm white, but you know, for me, what we share as men is much greater than what separates us culturally. From an initiation point of view, I think we could learn lots from our Aboriginal brothers. But by the same merit, I want to say it's our common manhood that we hold that really gives us much more in common than our cultural differences. So let's learn from one another's culture, but let's recognise this is a journey that we travel together as men.
Yes. And do you see that there's an urgency in getting this message out?
There is an urgency, but in a sense it's waited a long, long time too. But I think what's growing is the sense of urgency. I mean, for me it was probably urgent 30, 40 years ago. But it's encouraging that sense of urgency is becoming much more widely considered.
What about the positive aspects of modern life? The fact that more fathers are spending more time with their children, that more men are aware of the problems with their boys, and you would think from the raised awareness and the fact that people are showing more interest in the development of boys, why aren't we seeing positive? Why aren't we seeing more positives from this general thrust that fathers especially are taking a lot more interest in their children, and obviously not just their male children, but children generally. Why in the face of this, which would seem to be an enlightenment in parenting, why do we appear to still be going backwards, do you think?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know if we're going backwards, but we're certainly not going forwards at a rapid enough pace. But firstly, it is really encouraging to see dads being more involved. But in my work with dads, a lot of dads are saying to me, hey, I don't actually know how to help my boys through these years. I don't know how to do it. And of course, a lot of us as dads haven't necessarily been through this process ourselves, so we don't know what it means. And the other thing I think, as I read the initiation literature of other cultures, the thing that really strikes me is that it wasn't essentially a dad's role to guide his son into manhood. It was always a role of the men in the community,
tribal elders.
The tribal elders. And certainly in raising my own sons and watching them struggle through these years, I've been really conscious that there's a point as a dad where I can't do anything, and what they need is other men in their lives. And even sort of working in the field and with a special interest, as a dad, I found it really difficult to say, hey, how can I find a structure where my boys are interacting with other men in that positive way?
Yeah, I would agree with you. I've got an 11-year-old son, and as far as I can tell, he's pretty much coming up to the need for some sort of initiation. And really, where do I turn? There's really nowhere to go. I mean, I've spoken to a number of my friends about it. you know, his godfather, his uncles, but there doesn't seem to be anything in our society where a young boy can be initiated.
And I think, Bill, there's probably a real place to be bringing groups of dads together around these questions about how can we be there for each other's boys through the next several years.
Yes, I mean, we're probably stuck in this paradigm of going to work every day and seeing the kids for an hour or so before they go to bed, and then do it all again. And it's,
and I guess culturally, you know, we have this this is my family, my business, whereas this almost calls us to a much broader approach that says, look, I invite you to take an interest and a role in my children's lives. I invite you or beg you to take an active interest in my boy's transition into manhood.
Mm.
And I guess, too, it's sort of about recognising, hey, there's a whole lot that I can't do as a dad.
Yes, and it would work both ways. I mean, and the extreme when it doesn't work is you've worked in suicide prevention, and I guess that's an area of growing concern for young boys.
Well, certainly we all know that our males are well overrepresented in suicide statistics.
Yeah, getting back to the attitude of our society towards fatherhood and men generally, I mean, to just relate another personal experience of mine, interrupt here with it, but I was recently in Vietnam and I was sitting on the side of the road with a group of Vietnamese men having a beer that they'd offered me, and suddenly a three-year-old girl was plonked in my lap. And she seemed quite happy. She looked at me, a strange white person, obviously a foreigner, and just carried on. And then someone came along and picked her up, and off she went. I mean, that sort of thing wouldn't happen here. I've never had, you know, a three-year-old girl, a stranger, put in my lap here. And you'd kind of think here people would be jumping up and down in horror if something like that happened.
Because we have all sorts of perceptions.
We have a lot of cultural, paranoia. We have a lot of fear in our culture that men are dangerous and brutal and possibly can't be trusted in these situations. Whereas in that situation in Vietnam, there was nothing. Suddenly, I was the one who was more shocked than anybody else. Suddenly, this little girl appears on my lap, and she was perfectly happy with it. I think I was probably more uncomfortable than anybody else in the group.
And certainly in my work, I've just picked that up. I've promoted a notion, what I call community fathering.
Yes.
How can we learn together as a group of men to father our boys and our girls? Because I think there's enormous benefit in that. In what it takes a village to raise a child, we've all heard it, but I think we're far from the reality.
So we're speaking with Stephen Toon, Stephen, just coming back to your symposium in Adelaide, I wonder if you could just take us through some of the speakers and some of the topics again on what people can expect at this symposium.
Yep. So we have Miles Groff, who I believe has been on your program, from the Department of Psychology at Wagner College in New York. Miles will be just talking on his topic is the boy is father to the man. I can't tell you any more about that other than I've heard Miles speak on a number of occasions. I'm really looking forward. He really does have a lot of insight into this journey into manhood. He's done a lot of work in the college setting in America, working with younger men in groups. So I think he'll have a lot of interesting things to say. John Giardini is a well-known child psychologist. He has a significant interest in I don't want to put words in his mouth, but the way we use medication in boys and whether that's always the best response, or whether there are better ways to help boys rather than just instantly medicating them.
It's very topical.
Very topical. And then Celia Lashley, I know, has been a recent contributor to your program. She's spent many years in the New Zealand prison system, an anthropologist. She'll be talking about the world of boys in the 21st century, what sort of boys are up against. We're hoping the input, we're certain that the input from those three speakers will create a lot of opportunity to think, and then we'll be running some discussion and some question time to try and put together some ways forward and help people to work through their own practice and how they might apply it.
Yeah, look, it sounds going to be a great program. Now, if people want to have some more inquiries or want to find out how they can register, where should they go to?
Can I point them to our website, which is AIMHS, www.dads.com.au. I don't know if you're able to put a link to that.
Yes, we can put we'll be putting all this on our website, and that terrific. Will certainly be a link on the website.
So aims.com.au, and there's a button there on the homepage to the symposium. In fact, there's an advert down the each side at the moment of the homepage.
That's great, and I see one of the sponsors is the University of South Australia, so it's good to see they're getting behind this.
Yes, no, they've been very supportive of our work. In fact, we're collaborating with them on a number of projects.
That's great to see. Well, Stephen, we're running out of time at this end, but Ma, thank you very much for coming on the program and telling us about this exciting work you're doing. It couldn't be more important, I think, what you're talking about, the growth of boys to men in our community. It's just of such overwhelming importance. So we wish you all the best, and once again, thank you very much for coming on our program.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Stephen.
Well, I've come home, baby, and I've been working all night long. Put my daughter on my knee. And she said, "Daddy, what's wrong?" She whispered in my ear so sweet. You know what she said? She said, "Ooh, Daddy, you're a fool to cry. You're a fool to cry. And it makes me out of town. Mm-hmm. But I go see her sometime. We make love so fine. I put my head on her shoulder. She said, "Tell me all the trouble." You know what she said? She said, "Ooh, Daddy, you're a fool to cry.
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you're ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 22nd day of February 2011, and our thanks to Stephen Toon who's a director of the Consultancy and Community Programs Australian Institute of Male Health and Studies, and he was talking to us about the Male Studies Symposium that's coming up in Adelaide on the 24th of June. So once again, if people are interested, if you want to get some more information, go to that website. That's if you put in your search engine AIM, that's M for Molly, hs.com.au, and follow the links to the symposia, and you'll get all the information on the day in Adelaide, 24th of June 2011. Now, another story that's come across our desk. This is one from Scotland. It shows that these problems are not limited to Australia. They're worldwide problems that seem to bob up everywhere. In this story by Stephen Naismith, he talks about Mr. Ian Maxwell, who is the recently appointed Scottish National Development Manager for the charity Families Need Fathers. People might want to check on that charity as well, Families Need Fathers. It's a UK charity which works to ensure both parents continue to have a relationship with children after a family breakdown. Mr. Maxwell says the calls have come in at a steady stream at least since last year. Over the first 6 months of Families Need Fathers, they took on 100 cases, and this figure is now growing at the rate of 10 a week. Mr. Maxwell says the calls received by the charity follow a familiar pattern, familiar to all of us, I think. We get the phone call again and again, he says. We split up, and this is fathers calling, and they say, we split up, and for a while it was okay, I saw my children. Then we couldn't get agreement, or their mother has a new partner, or we had a dispute, and my contact with my children was cut or is gone. He refers to some cases more troubling than others. He said there's been one where a father has an indirect contact order, which prevents him even from sending his children Easter eggs. Another has an arrangement which permits him 2 hours a month of contact with his child, which, as Mr. Maxwell points out, is less than a prison would allow. So form part of the well over 10,000 divorces a year in Scotland, at least 3,500 of which involve children. And even if only 5% of these separations are hostile and another 10% are very difficult, it still means thousands of families who could do with some help.
No, absolutely. That story of a father who can't even send his kids Easter eggs, that's appalling.
Yeah, well, we've got similar ones in Australia, I think, involving postcards. So, as I say, it is a worldwide problem.
And, of course, there was that gentleman who we interviewed last year or the year before who was put in jail for waving at his kids.
Yep.
The mother found it offensive and was terrified and frightened, and he ended up spending 3 months in jail.
Yep, it's extraordinary. And, of course, custody contests can also lead to false allegations of child abuse or domestic violence. We're talking Scotland, remember, but it just sounds so familiar. He does say that it's a difficult issue, but of course people who genuinely suffer domestic violence need protection, but it shouldn't tip the scales so much that a mother who wants to stop her father seeing the children can just raise the issue of domestic violence purely to harm his case, and then that leads to sometimes years of torture for the parent, that usually the father trying to see
children as well,
and the children
denied contact with their father. It's probably more devastating for them in the long run.
Yep. So at least in Scotland, this new group, Families Need Fathers, is trying to fill the gap and to get some more information out there. This is in places like Glasgow and Hamilton. So there is a link from between Australia and Scotland in this very difficult area, and we can only hope that taking the positive note from Stephen Toon that we're on the right track to improve some of these areas. So we might go to a short break and we'll be back shortly.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you. I walked out this morning and I wrote down this song. I just can't remember who to send it to. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you again. Won't you look down upon me, Jesus? You gotta help me make a stand. Just got to see me through another day. My body's aching and my time is at hand. I won't make it any other way. Whoa, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. Seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you again. Been walking my mind to an easy time, my back turned towards the sun. Lord knows when the cold wind blows, it'll turn your head around. Well, there's hours of time on the telephone line to talk about things to come. Buying machines in pieces on the ground. Whoa, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you, baby, one more time again now. Thought I'd see you one more time again. There's just a few things coming my way this time around now. Thought I'd see you fine.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air, and we're just about the end of the show for another week, so I'd like to particularly thank our guests this week. We had Jason Van Genderen, the runner-up in Tropfest this year with his film The Unspoken, and Stephen Toon, the Director of Consultancy and Community Programs from the Australian Institute of Male Health and Studies, talking about the symposium coming up in Adelaide in June of this year. So once again, thanks to our guests, and we'll be back next week with another great show. In the meantime, if you'd like to hear those interviews again, you'd like to hear the show again, go to our website, www.dadsontheair.net. And you should stay tuned now for Country On with our friend Country Bob. In the meantime, from Bill Cable, Ian Purdy and Phil York, it's bye for now from Dads on the Air.
We ask over questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.